Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 16th, 2008, and this is show number 141. Well, I want to start off the show by thanking Mike for writing in about a little bit of an error that I made about a John Colton song that I had on the show 2 weeks ago. Hannes had played it during a review he had, and I referred to it as a song, Aperture Science. But instead, the actual name of the song is actually Still Alive. I put a link in the show notes to jonathancolton.com that will take you right to the song. Thanks, Mike. I hate to A, forget to give him credit the first time, and then B, botch the credit. Well, I got an email this week from Nick Tamburi from tamburi.net that really made my day. Here's his letter. I remember hearing on a Mac ReviewCast episode that you like RPN calculators on Mac OS X. I don't know if you'd be interested in another one, but I released a freeware HP 67 emulator called 67, but spelled LXVII. I wrote it as a way to learn Mac OS X programming, and it has some features most other calculators don't, like programmability, the ability to have multiple calculators running at once, and my personal favorite, mouseless operation by mapping all buttons to the keyboard. If nothing else, I'll bet Tim has never heard of it. Thanks for your reviews on the Mac ReviewCast. I always enjoy them. Now, I did actually do a review over on the Mac ReviewCast of this very tool, and I think you'll enjoy the review over there as well, but I wanted to make sure you guys knew about it here. By the way, we did stump the podcaster with this one. Well, I'm really excited about this calculator, which is why I want to do the review in both places. I know it's about as geeky as you can imagine to be excited about a calculator, but and especially the reverse Polish notation or RPN calculators. These are the only ones I know how to use. I'm serious. If I sit down at a normal calculator with a 3 plus 5 equals, I don't know how to do any complex operations at all. Now, this is the HP 67 that he's done an emulator for, and I never had one myself. Only our friend Drew could afford one of those. The very first calculator I ever used was my dad's HP 35 in 1976, the year I graduated high school. In my junior year when I was in chemistry class, I actually still used a slide rule. Yeah. Well, anyway, my dad paid $400 for the HP 35 back in 1976. Later on in college, I had an HP 45, and today I use an HP 11C that I got during graduate school. Steve still uses his HP 15C he got in graduate school, and I also still have my dad's 11C. All three calculators are working flawlessly 25 years after we got them. You can see why I love HP calculators, right? Well, Nick sent in three links to your favorite sites to download 67, the emulator that he wrote. He sent us a link to Apple.com, VersionTracker.com, and MacUpdate.com, so you can pick the one you like. I downloaded and installed 67, and I really like it. My requirements these days aren't that tough, but I like how fast it comes up, how easy it is to use, and how I can slide out the registers so I can see what's in the storage registers, in the programs, and in the stack. If you've ever used an HP calculator, you'll know what I'm talking about. There's a manual you want to read in order to get the most out of the 67 emulator, too. Nick actually played right into the new homework assignment I am starting this week. As Nick mentioned, I have this little contest going with Tim Verporten of the Mac ReviewCast. Tim challenged me to stump the podcaster, saying that I would not be able to find freeware that he didn't already review or at least know about. I've gotten him once or twice, but mostly he's winning. I even reviewed Launchy, which is freeware for Windows, and it turned out he'd already installed it on his work machine, so I didn't win on that one. One time I was jogging, listening to a show, and I thought, hey, I'll review FreeMind. I bet he hasn't heard of that one. And in the next step, I heard him on the Mac ReviewCast talking about FreeMind. I need to beat him some more times. Luckily, like I said, with 67, we got another point in our favor. So, here's how you can help me stump Tim. If you know of some freeware you haven't heard me review before, search for it on Tim's site at macreviewcast.com and search on podfeet.com as a favor to me to make me not have to go look it up. If it's not on either site, bring it on and we'll really make him crazy. Thanks, Nick. I really appreciate you sending in the calculator, and it is my calculator of choice now for sure. So you all know about crazy listener James, right? He's really not stable, I think, and he frightens me a little bit. You can imagine how nervous I was when he asked if Steve and I would go see him perform in his band, The Lost Marauders, on Tuesday night. I mean, seriously, let's look at the facts. A, I don't listen to any music. None, not a zip, not any at all. B, he was playing at 9 p.m. on a school night. I mean, come on, I'm fully in my jammies by 9 o'clock at night. And C, I don't even go out for people I like. I mean, I don't go out. Anyway, he was so hurt and sad. He actually begged at one point. It was pathetic, actually. So I promised I'd pimp his band for him. I put a link in the show notes to lostmarauders.com/iTunes so you can go check out Lost Marauders and their new album called The Road Unknown. I suppose there's a remote chance this music is worth listening to, so go check it out for yourself. Please, get him off my back. It's time for a public service announcement. It's time for our annual reminder to watch out for phishing scams. Phishing is the nasty practice of sending emails that trick you into giving up personal information or downloading viruses and spyware. How do they do it? Well, they send you an email that looks like something legitimate from your bank or some other institution that you might actually want to do business with. Don't worry, though, I'm going to remind you of how to recognize these scams and protect yourself. The reason I'm bringing it up right now is I just got a really good one. They are getting so clever these days. This one was supposedly from Hallmark. It said that someone had sent me an e-card and showed a link that said hallmark.com/get-e-card. What you need to know is how links are created in a web page. When I create a link in my blog, I type in two things. One is the real link that you'll get sent to when you click, but I also type in anything I want as what you're going to see on the link. For example, I could create a link to google.com, but I could make it say yahoo.com in text, so you'd think you were going to Yahoo, but you were actually going to Google. Does that make sense? So, the reason I explained all that is what these evil pests do is they put a nasty link in the email, but the text says something innocuous like hallmark.com. The particular hairballs that sent me this Hallmark card were extremely clever. The text said, and I quote, "If this name is not familiar to you and you're concerned about online security, please use the following steps. Visit hallmark.com/get-e-card. Enter your email address in the original recipient's email address box. Enter," and then they gave me a really long code. It said, "in the confirmation number box. Click display greeting." Well, when you look at that, the only thing that looked funny at all was they said original recipients, and recipients was spelled recipient.s instead of no dot. So a weird little typo in there. But anyway, you look at this and you think, gee, this must be real because they gave me a way to prove it's right. And then you click the link. Luckily for me, in Apple Mail, I can simply hover over links to see where they'll really send me. It pops up on screen. I took a screenshot of my Hallmark example so you could see that the link is actually a Windows executable file that I would have downloaded had I clicked that button. Well, just for grins and giggles, I also tried following their steps, typing carefully that URL into my browser and entering the code, and of course, Hallmark did not recognize it. It turns out if you're using a browser like, Gmail using a web-based browser, you won't be able to just hover over these links necessarily and see where they go. So, what's the lesson here? Never click on a link in an email. Even if it's from someone you know, it can be a scam sent through their email to people in their address book. The best thing you can do is just copy the link text, which I'm assuming looks like a real link, and then paste it into your browser. You'll be safe as pie if you do that. Well, Haunted Bob has been searching all over for a solution to his database problem. As you may recall, he had a really old program that only ran under XP, but now he's got his new Vista laptop. A ton of you guys have written in with such great ideas for new database programs for Bob, and I really appreciate all the help. Michael was a late entrant because his mom fell and broke her wrist the day he heard the request for help on the show. I sure hope your mom's wrist is mending well, Michael. I broke my wrist once and, shockingly, did not enjoy it one little bit. So anyway, after all the help you guys gave Bob, I had an epiphany. I told him he should just put XP on his new machine. It's way easier than learning a new database program and moving all that data. I'm not sure what he's going to do, but I thought it was a fun solution. And then he turned on me. He started doing his impression of QA Director Steve. I think he wants Steve's job. He went back and listened to some of the old commercials I've done for him, and he's picking out mistakes. Can you believe that? Well, way back in July of 2007, I told the story of how long Steve's 1986 Prelude lasted because of Bob's tender, loving care. I said we sold it in 1988, so it lasted 14 years. Well, that would be like 2 years. Well, it turns out it was supposed to be 1998, but then again, that's still only 12 years, right? Well, anyway, I think I got it doubly wrong because we actually sold this car in 2000, so it was 14 years old. Okay, so a little math problem. What's the big deal? Well, as if that weren't enough, he found another mistake back in the show on February 11th, 2007. And that's more than a year ago, guys, right? Well, in that episode, I was talking about the exciting subject of fuel injectors, and I mentioned that Honda Bob had replaced the ones on my 1984 Accord. The mistake is that, fuel injection didn't actually enter the Honda product line until 1985. Okay, so it must have been my 1998 Accord I was thinking of, all right? In fact, I'm not sure I even owned a 1984 Accord. I think it was a 1983 Accord. Anyway, don't you think there should be some sort of statute of limitations on calling out errors to my podcast? I think so. Well, anyway, if you'd like your fuel injectors replaced on your Honda or Acura, or just some good solid maintenance to keep those cars running in perfect condition, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartbouchatz.ie. Finally, we're back together, Bart.
Yeah, it's been a while. I'm glad you had a good time over in Sedona. Really enjoyed the pictures, actually. It looks like a fabulous place.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad you like that. Well, I appreciate you carrying the show while I was gone and sending in your episode without me. That was good, even though you did mock my commitment to the show.
But only vaguely. And then I agreed with you. It's all good.
There you go. Hey, so before we got on the air, Bart and I were talking about I went with a friend of mine to buy a new MacBook Pro, but I had to drive all the way out to her house, which is quite a ways east of us. And then we drove south to a big mall that has an Apple store in it. And that was great. And drove all the way back. And I hit traffic along the whole way. It took me forever. And I did the math. I'd driven 104 miles to go to the mall. Bart had an interesting reaction to that.
Yeah, it's like, that's, in Ireland, those distances are insane. You don't do that in a day. That's the kind of thing you plan, you know? If I were to go 104 mile due west, I'd get very wet feet because I'd be in the Atlantic. And if I went 104 mile due east, I'd have wet feet for a while as I went through the entire Irish Sea and popped out in Wales.
You could actually make it to Wales.
Yeah, I could make it to Holyhead.
And going due west, you said you could get, now you're in Dublin, or in Maynooth, which is near Dublin, right?
Yeah, we're a little bit outside Dublin. Yeah, I could get the whole way across Ireland to the Atlantic.
And I went to the mall.
Yeah.
Well, I was telling Bart, I'm always rubbing it in about the weather in California and our temperatures and everything, but man, are there a lot of people here. The traffic was killing me today.
Yeah, that's because you have to drive everywhere over there. Well, I can get everywhere I need to go on my bicycle.
Wow, that's crazy. I can get to the beach on my bicycle. That's about it. Well, maybe we should actually start the show. We've been goofing around all afternoon or evening for you, right, Bart?
Well, it has been an hour since we actually started up Skype.
Is it that long? Jeez. All right. Well, what we thought we'd talk about today is Bart does a lot of really spectacular photography, and I take snapshots, but I pretend I'm a photographer with my SLR and everything. We both have the Nikon D40, and we were starting to talk about what kind of tools we use for photo editing and what our workflow is and that kind of thing. And so we thought we'd talk a little bit about that. So what do you use to organize your photos to start with, Bart?
First off, those Sedona pics weren't snapshots. But anyway, you don't give yourself enough credit. My main tool is iPhoto. I'm absolutely, totally in love with iPhoto. As soon as I plug in my camera, the stuff gets sucked into iPhoto, automatically gets broken up into events. I use iPhoto for cropping. I think the white balance adjustment is fantastic. Hmm. Although I have started to use manual white balance settings on the camera because the automatic tends to make things look a bit funny. People with funny color skin and stuff. And then what I really love about iPhoto is the way it lets you bring up the shadows. So it's not quite HDR photography because you're not actually taking in, you know, more information like you do with the HDR, but it does allow you to really bring up those shadows so that you get something that looks more normal and less like a photograph, if that makes any sense.
I had never played with any of that in there.
Yeah, it's the shadow tool is particularly cool, but never go above 10.
Okay.
On that adjust slider. That's what I've learned the hard way. Now, anything between 6 and 10 works nice, but if you go higher than that, not good.
Now, one of the things I didn't like about iPhoto, well, there's a couple of reasons I don't use it, and in talking about the editing of the photos, is you end up with multiple copies of your photos, so your hard drive fills up.
Well, two.
Well, yeah, but that's twice as many as I would have if I don't do that. If I do it in Photoshop Elements, I'll bring it in, do all the editing, and then save it out on top of the old file, and I've got one, and I've saved it down as a JPEG, so it's even smaller.
Yeah, well, these are two JPEGs, and I don't like destructive editing because I invariably make a mess of things. Something really nice in iPhoto is if you hit the Shift key while you're editing, it shows you the original, and you're like, oh, the Shift key, and it shows you what you have now. Because if you start messing with sliders enough, you'll eventually actually make things worse than when you started. So, you know, a little hold down the Shift key, it's like, oh, wait, no, I've undone that. Right-click, revert to original, start again.
I guess that would be nice. And again, I look at my photos as being snapshots, so they're not the great art epic of all time or anything. So, I'm almost out of disk space as it is. I think I have a 120 gig drive on my MacBook Pro, and I've got 6 gig left now. So
yeah, I'm down to quite a few gigs as well. But at the same time, like when you think about it, you can take an awful lot of photographs for one GarageBand file for a half-hour podcast.
That's true. Well, I do have to destroy all of my AIFFs for to get disk space back. That's for sure. That's where a lot of it gets chewed up. But we were kind of talk about this at the end. But one of the advantages I heard about Aperture is that it's non-destructive, but it does not make a copy of your photo. So Bart and I have both been talking about whether we should buy Aperture. It's about $200 from Apple, and it's got a very iPhoto-like interface from what I understand. But they said that the edits you make are more like metadata on the file, sort of like what Wiretap Studio does to audio files. It's here's the real image, and then here's what you apply to it in order to make the image you want.
Yeah, that's exactly how it does it. Aperture is more for if you start shooting RAW rather than shooting JPEG. And I was very, very tempted because I committed some unexpected money this week because my hosting provider made a slight boo-boo and managed to forget to invoice me.
Oh.
But I was nice enough to point this out to them, and they were in return nice enough to lop off a few hundred euro for my annual hosting bill.
Wow.
So that saved me a few euro. Yeah, well, I was onto the phone to them about four times trying to pay them.
Oh, that's good they took care of you, though. So
they didn't even tell me they were going to. Anyway, yeah, so I thought, okay, I have a bit of money. What do I want to buy? Aperture has been tempting me for ages, but I've decided not to, and I'll tell you why. I don't have the disk space to shoot RAW.
Well, but I asked that specific question to David Sparks from MacSparky.com, and he said there's nothing about it that keeps you from using JPEGs on it.
Yeah, but the big reason I'd want to go to Aperture is to make the big step into shooting RAW. iPhoto does everything I want when it comes to JPEGs. So, you know, shooting RAW was sort of the next step as far as I'm concerned. And I can't make that step at the moment. So I need money to buy a bigger hard disk for my MacBook Pro. But then I haven't got money for Aperture anymore.
Now, one of the things that bugs me about iPhoto is the organization of it. I'm really anal, and I've been taking digital photos. I know my first digital photo was a picture of Kyle when he was in maybe fourth or fifth grade, and he's 17 now. So that's been about, what's fourth grade, 4-11? That's he's 17, so it's like 6 years of digital photography, and I take a lot of pictures. So I have them in categories of date ranges, and then within the date ranges, I've got folders for all the events, and then the photos are named. If I bring those into iPhoto, first of all, I'm going to duplicate everything, but I can't have those hierarchical folders set up like that in iPhoto.
You can, you can. It won't do it automatically, but you can.
I don't think you can create a photo in a folder inside a folder.
You can now. You didn't used to be able to, but you can now.
Okay, I have not tried in 08.
No, that's it. I probably knew in 08 then, but you certainly can in 08, definitely.
Can I point to a folder from iPhoto without copying the files into iPhoto?
No. iPhoto is... But no, it's... You're not... The whole point of iPhoto is that it's a place to manage your photos. It sucks it in and you never worry about them again.
Blah. I'm not willing to give up all I've done.
But you don't have to. Once you suck it in, it's in. And you can delete the originals.
Right, but I've got thousands and thousands and thousands of them in these structured folders, and I would have to recreate that.
It'll make the events automatically based on date.
Right.
So then if you want to make some folders and drag them back across, but I don't actually find the need for the hierarchical stuff. I used to do exactly the same when I actually managed my own photos. Mm-hmm. But with iPhoto, I don't find the need for that sort of hierarchical stuff, because with the searching and stuff, if you want to go back to 2007 or whatever, you just do.
Yeah, that's true. But the other thing is, if you name a photo, it doesn't change the name of the file, which bothers me, because then, like, let's say I take a set of photos and I put them up in JAlbum into an album online. I purposely put the names on them so the names would show up, but now the names won't be there anymore. It's going to be image_65041.
No, that's if you take them off the file system. If you go to an album or an event and export it, you have lots of options how it should name the files, and one option is name it the way you've named it.
So now I have a third or fourth copy of the photo.
No, you upload it and you're done with it. Like,
well, but so I'm going to export it. I'm going to create that third copy, and now I'm going to create a J album, which is going to create a fourth copy, and then upload the J album full of stuff up to the website.
Yeah, and then delete all the stuff. But the J album won't create a fourth copy, will it?
Yeah, because it creates the smaller version of them and the thumbnails and all that kind of stuff. So I'm at 2 gig down by then.
Once you have the J album uploaded, you can delete all the temporary stuff.
Yeah, you can. You can. But if you want to go back and edit it, you got to start over. And I frequently make changes along the way, at least for a little while. So anyway, we've gotten way off the topic, though.
Yeah, we have. Well, in that case, you'd be much better off using the .Mac galleries.
I like the skins and stuff and being able to put it anywhere I want. Because I put them on different blogs services.
No, I absolutely love iPhoto. I use it to manage all my photographs. I'm big into tagging. Tagging is my thing. I tag everything. Mm. I tag files in the file system so that Spotlight can give me more sensible results. I'm tag mad. So I'm always tagging stuff. So it means if I want to find something silly like, you know, photographs of a tree, I just type in tree and it's going to find them because I've tagged everything.
And you said you do that in the file system, not in iPhoto?
No, I do it in iPhoto for my photographs, but literally documents and stuff, I will tag them. I will go Apple I and I will type in stuff into the Spotlight comments. I put stuff into the Spotlight comments of my files so that Spotlight can really find stuff.
Ooh, you know, I'm always looking for more ways to be anal retentive. I might start doing that. I've actually never tagged a photo or a file like that at all.
Yeah, it's it used to be important that if you wanted to find stuff, you had to be sure to put it in a sensible place. And then if a file fitted into more than one hierarchy, then it was really hard to decide where to put it. Nowadays, I just sort of blob all my files in a great big heap and tag the hell out of them.
Interesting.
And let Spotlight sort it out. You know, don't worry about me finding stuff. As long as I know I've tagged the hell out of them, I'll let Spotlight sort it out.
You know, you make a good point there. I know they talked about how in the original design of the interweb there, they tried to structure it, and then they realized, you know, it's insane. There's just too much information. Let's just make it where you can find stuff. And if you don't care about structure and you don't have to have a folder that says 2006, you know, October, Halloween, but if you can type pumpkin in the tag, you're going to find it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Except you don't do Halloween probably, right?
Actually, I have some lovely pictures of pumpkins from when I spent Halloween in the States a couple years back.
See? And I bet they're tagged, right?
Of course they are. Anyway.
So you do a couple of things.
I keep everything in iPhoto. That's my store, my one place where everything is, and that's my definitive collection. Mm-hmm. And anything out of there is just an export, which I can delete or whatever, and I don't care about losing it. And my iPhoto library is backed up both off-site and at home. I'm very retentive about that. So if I then want to put photos on the web or something into my gallery on my website, I run through basically my little sort of few-step thing. So the first step is export it out of iPhoto, and the export from iPhoto is quite good, so I actually resize it to a maximum dimension of 800 while I'm doing that. So in one step, it's out of iPhoto and resized so that it's either, you know, it's maximum dimension. So if it's a portrait photo, then it'll be 800 high, and if it's a landscape photo, it'll be 800 wide.
You do that in iPhoto, in your export from iPhoto?
Yeah, export lets you do that, yeah.
Okay.
Then I run a little, so Image Magic, I think we've mentioned before, is a fantastic suite of command line tools that let you do stuff to images from the command line. So I've written some little Perl scripts that literally you run them inside a folder and it takes all the JPEG files in the folder, plowsing through that script. So I have a script to stick in the Creative Commons logo. I have a script to stick in my URL. I have a script for sticking in captions or attributions if I need to. Then I SFTP the whole lot up to the web server and click on the little import button in my gallery software. And hey presto, photos on the web.
I see. Now,
is
Image Magic also... I'm sorry, but Image Magic is also available for Windows, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's open source, and I'd found it out there.
Yeah, oh, it's fantastic. It's cross-platform. There's extensions for it. It's tied into programming languages as well. So you have JMagic for doing it through Java, and there's loads of different ones. It's a fantastic, fantastic suite of tools.
Now, I wonder if there's two of them. I think Image Magic, the one I'm thinking of ends in it, is M-A-G-I-C-K.
M-A-G-I-K, yeah. Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. I just want to make sure we didn't talk about two different ones. Well, that sounds interesting.
No, that's it. Yeah, it's fantastic. But again, it's a command line jobby. So it's great if you're good on the command line or if you don't mind writing a script. So I spent probably an hour writing those scripts.
Hmm.
But, you know, I can export 100 photographs and have them all resized with the logos, with my credit in them, in a matter of 10 seconds or so.
Wow.
You know, so suddenly imagine doing that even once for 200 photographs. That's going to be more than an hour's work.
Right.
I've made back the time I've spent writing those scripts 100 times over by now.
Now, for those of us who are script challenge, I wonder, I think they've got a few, some interface things that you can download to see whether you can maybe steal some stuff, it looks like.
I'm sure someone's written GUIs to these kind of things.
Yeah.
I mean, as I said, they're completely free tools, so someone out there must have had the bright idea to stick a GUI on it.
Yeah, that would be
I haven't
nice.
Looked for one because I have my scripts and I'm happy.
Now, what if you want to do some fancy editing? What do you do?
Yeah, I don't do much fancy editing, but when I want to do something like a wallpaper, to me, a wallpaper has to be like the uber cream of the crop. I have very few wallpapers up, even though I have thousands of images. I have 2,240 in my iPhoto library and 130 events, and I think I have something like 15 or something wallpapers. So when I do a wallpaper, I pick the absolute best of the best images, and then I process them so they look as best they can. Right, so sometimes I like to get arty and do something like, you know, make an entire photo monochrome apart from one bit. So
I love think pictures a nice like one. That.
Yeah, so you do that basically by making a black and white version and overlaying it on your color version, turning it into a mask, and then painting in the bit that you want to cut out of the mask. So the color image shines through on just the bit that you've colored in. So I think I have one there of a butterfly sitting on an entirely black and white landscape, but you have this fantastically colorful butterfly in color.
Oh, yeah.
You
sent me the link, you know. So I'll put that in the show notes so everybody can see it. Yeah, I think it's a monarch with orange and black and blue, but it's on black and white.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure it is a monarch, but I should really look that up. I'm terrible at butterfly stuff. I'm pretty good with plants, but don't ask me about butterflies. And then the other thing I love to do, to me, you know, a wallpaper, it has to be fairly vibrant. Otherwise, it just looks dead. So I like to do something called an LAB color boost. And basically what you do is you explode the photograph into three different layers in the LAB color space. Then you tweak the curves, which has the effect of boosting the color. And then you recollapse it back into a single photograph.
Hmm.
And it gives what I call a postcard look. So
super
all
intense,
the colors
huh?
are still as they were. Yeah, but the greens are that bit more intense. The blues are that bit more intense. And you know the way a postcard never looks real?
Yeah. Yeah.
Looks like some sort of idealized world. That's exactly the look you get out. You get an idealized grassy whatever, you know, or an idealized lake or an idealized river. So I like to do that for the wallpapers as well.
Now,
and I do all that in the game.
You keep saying LAB color boost. Do you know what LAB stands for?
I have no idea what the LAB color space is. So you have lots of different hypothetical color spaces, like RGB is the most common one, which I know is red, green, blue. And then you have another one, which is hue, saturation, something, which is HS, something or other.
Oh.
And then LAB is just another one of these. I have absolutely no idea what it means, but I know that if I mess with the L and the A layer and leave the B layer alone, when I put them back together, it looks fantastic.
Huh, interesting. Well, I found a video tutorial.
It's black magic, but I've no idea. Actually, I have a link to a link. If that makes any sense, in a blog post I did a while ago. Some guy has done a screencast of how you do it, and it's actually quite straightforward, but I've no idea how it works. It's just black magic to me.
So you'll send that along as well?
I will send that along as well.
Great, great. I found a little video tutorial explaining what LAB Color Boost means. Maybe that's it's the story behind LAB Color Boost.
Will you send that on to me? Then I may actually learn something.
That sounds good. Well, it sounds like you do some pretty interesting things. I'd like to try doing some of that with a few of my my better shots. I do have my rare moments when I wouldn't call them snapshots. Something I'm really excited about is I took a bunch of pictures of a friend of the show, Margaret's front yard. She tore out all of the flowers or all of the grass in her front yard, and she planted all native California plants and flowers. So they're not, you know, roses with, a mowed lawn kind of a look. It's this just vibrant, just cacophony of beautiful flowers and just, it's almost like a chorus, all everybody yelling at the same time. It's just fantastic. And I got some just outstanding photos that I keep promising to show you, Bart. Maybe I can play with
someone. I was just going to say, this all sounds awfully familiar, and I'm still waiting in, you know, great anticipation. No, I absolutely love that kind of wildflower garden. And like, especially in a place like California, we have the weather for it. I mean, it really must be a riot of color, I believe the phrase is.
That's the phrase I'm looking for. It is a riot of color. And she's got about, I don't know, 25 or 30 different varieties in there. And she knows the names of all of them, none of which I retained.
Well, you should ask her to identify them so you can name the photographs appropriately. Maybe. But no, those Sedona pictures with the red rocks and the blue sky, they would look fantastic with an LAB color boost on them.
That's right. You were going to fix one of them up for me and show me what you can do, right? Maybe I will actually get around to that too.
I was going to say you were supposed to email me one and then I was going to do it. Yeah, but no, some of those should be fantastic, especially if there's one where you have some of the green shrubs and stuff in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
They should really make fantastic wallpapers.
I think
the key for wallpapers is that the detail on the photograph shouldn't be on the same scale as the lettering on your icons, and then it'll be fine.
Well, hey, maybe... Do you still have... did you ever load Jing on your computer?
Nope.
Because that one was... that's the one where you can just set it up to watch your screen, and you could do the LAB color boost, and we could see how you did it.
Sure. Isn't Jing one of those ones that you had to get a beta invite or something?
No. It's from TechSmith. It's the people who make Camtasia Studio for Windows, but they came out with Jing for both Windows and Mac.
Okay, well, if you send me the link to that, then I think we will do that sometime between now and next week.
If I actually mail you a photograph.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. We certainly blathered on a long time, I think.
20 minutes.
That's about right. That's what I think people can just about stand, right?
Yeah, although I did think our target was 15. But anyway, we live.
All right, Bart. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you this week, and I hope we get a chance to talk again next week.
So do I. And as always, until next time, happy computing.
Well, after Bart and I got off the phone, I went into iPhoto and I started poking around in the preferences. And on the Advanced tab, it turns out you can tell it to not copy the files into your iPhoto library after all. Now, I know most normal people would never choose this, but it might be just the thing to let me use iPhoto more productively. I decided to give it yet another try on Bart's enthusiastic recommendation. Well, I noticed one problem right off the bat. I tried to use iPhoto to cull out the less than desirable photos, so I deleted a bunch of them in iPhoto, but when I went back and looked at my disk, it had not deleted them on my hard drive. It must have just deleted the pointers or something to the files, or I wonder if I need to empty the trash. I don't know. I still don't have an ideal solution for my photo management workflow. My daughter Lindsay has a relatively new MacBook with a 120 gig hard drive. The other day, she mentioned to me that she only had about 6 gigabytes left on her drive. I asked her what the heck she's been filling her disk up with. She promptly pointed out that she inherited my excessive photo-taking gene. So she has around 10,000 or so digital photos. She manages them in iPhoto and edits virtually every one of them. So, as I just mentioned in talking to Bart, she has 2 copies of every photo. We started talking about options like having her pull some of her high school photos off of her main drive, but that seemed really sad and no fun. Then we ran Disk Inventory X from Derlian.com. That's my favorite program I've mentioned a bunch of times for graphically showing you where all your disk spaces run off to. We had to point it at the iPhoto library directly in order to see inside it, because ever since, I guess it was in Tiger, they now represent the iPhoto library as one big blob from the outside. When we looked in there, we realized that over 60% of her iPhoto library was actually AVI video files. Turns out she has a Canon digital camera that takes beautiful videos, and she loves to film her friends making fools of themselves at parties. She would be really sad to take those off her disk, but man, they were hogging up a ton of disk space. Well, at this point, we were figuring maybe Mom was about to shell out for a bigger hard drive, when I thought of something. I did a little experiment. I opened up Visual Hub, which is the fantastic $23 shareware application from Techspansion.com. I asked it nicely to convert one of these AVI files to an MP4 instead. We took an AVI file that was a minute 37, which, by the way, was 172 megabytes. After Visual Hub converted it to an MP4, it was only 12 megabytes. It went from 172 to 12.4 when we were done. Can you believe that? Now, you'd think this is going to be an awfully compressed video and it was going to look all nasty and pixelated, but we chose H.264 as the codec, which is a really, really efficient algorithm and does a great job, and these videos look beautiful. So, instead of shelling out, what do you think, about $100 for a big hard drive, I shelled out $23 and bought Visual Hub for her. Now, whenever she's bored, she's going to spend time converting her AVIs and regain all that disk space. I thought of another advantage of this plan a little later on. I have the same camera she does. And from my Sedona trip, I should say, I had two videos I wanted to put up on Facebook. I started the first one, which was one of the AVIs. It was taking forever because it was like 150 megabytes. Well, I took the second one while that first one was uploading. I took the second one, which was about as long, and I converted it in Visual Hub over to an MP4 file. The whole process only took like 2 minutes to convert that file, by the way. I should mention, it's really fast. It dropped the size by, again, more than a 10-to-1 ratio, and then I was able to upload it to Facebook, all before the first one had even finished. So, she's also not only going to have more disk space, she's going to have more fun uploading videos because they're going to go up way faster, she's going to gain the disk space, and she still gets to keep her digital life on her MacBook. Well, after I finished figuring all this out, I was telling my friend Mike about it, and he explained why these AVIs are so huge coming from the little digital cameras. He explained that the processor in these little cameras is very limited, and so it simply can't do the compression on the fly that's necessary to make the video smaller. So, these AVIs you get are actually uncompressed. Well, that explains a lot, doesn't it? I should talk to Mike more often. He's pretty smart. Well, it looks like that's going to wind things up for this show. I got a party to go to tonight, so I'm finishing up a little bit early. Please keep all your great emails coming to allison@podfeet.com. And don't forget your homework assignment to find freeware tools that neither Tim nor I have reviewed before. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.